Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jingyi Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today is Dr. Thomas Cullen, a professor of East Asian Studies and History from Princeton University. Thomas recently published Samurai and the Warrior Culture of Japan, from 471 to 1877, a source book. It's published through Hackett Publishing Company. This book is a collection of historical documents and literary works by the samurai class from ancient to early modern Japan. Welcome, Thomas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Jingyi. I'm delighted to be here today. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So before we jump into the book, what do you teach and research about?
Well, I do teach ancient and medieval Japanese history here at Princeton. And I really cover from the full range to around 1600. And I do a variety of topics, but a lot of what I work on focuses on the warrior culture and all that, because that's where a lot of my research has been on.
So how did you get interested in warrior culture?
Well, it's a funny story that when I was growing up as a kid, I had no connection with Japan whatsoever. And I remember just in junior high on a whim of buying a book about the samurai. I mean, I was interested in salamanders and lots of other things too, but I bought this book and I remember reading it and I thought, I don't believe this. I don't think this is true. I don't think that these people were willing to die and all that. And it just like the, all this sort of glorified stuff. But, you know, I just sort of put that aside. And as the years passed, I ended up, I went to Harvard Summer School and I decided I wanted to devote my life to Japan on a whim. And from there, I studied Japanese. And then I lived in Japan and Sendai for a while. Then I entered graduate school and went to Stanford. So that's kind of my story. And then one thing led to another. And I, you know, got my PhD from Stanford, taught at Bowdoin for a while. And now I'm teaching here at Princeton.
Nice. The warrior culture and samurai has always been such a popular subject among not just only learners of Japanology, but recently it's been taken up by Hollywood a lot as well. So what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I've always been kind of interested in revealing the samurai in their own voices in their own terms. And one thing is, maybe even as I tell you about like how my research began, is that I was really wondering, even as a PhD student, what am I going to write my dissertation on? And I went and I looked in the library and I found some pictures of these documents, and they're called petitions for reward. And what they are is these warriors would sort of, it's like an insurance claim, would list all their damages and everything that happened to them, including wounds and deaths and damages. And then they would request compensation, request rewards. And I realized that the term used, people used to think it's like loyalty, but it's like, no, they really needed compensation for their actions. And when I looked at the document, I realized it's a totally different view than what we normally see about these warriors, because one, they are not talking about dying in battle. If anything, they talk about how they don't die in battle, because it's, you know, it's, but they also are very careful about talking about all their various damages. So through that, I really decided that I want to to study this because a lot is knowable about the past. And then as I look at the sources, I realize there's this incredible diversity of sources that either people writing about warriors or the warriors themselves that are writing that are unknown because they're all written in very difficult language. It has never been translated. So that's why I really wanted to do this project. And I've tried to do some other source readers, but often there's a bias toward the, I call it a presentist bias, where some of the readers are like, we only want you to do 100 pages of pre-1868 or something. And I wanted to do something which really reveals the past on its own terms in a lot of ways. And so this is where Hackett Press is great. Rick Todd Hutter was the editor, and he approached me about doing something, and I said, oh, this sounds good. And I have over the years translated a lot of pieces, and so I decided, well, this would be a perfect thing to do, and he gave me a lot of freedom to put in what I wanted to put in, and that's how this book came about.
That's wonderful. So what's the structure of this book?
Well, it's roughly chronological, and that I wanted to sort of reproduce sources that are either by warriors or about warriors, but something direct, really. And so I started 471 because that's one of the oldest writings in Japan. So the first 500 years basically are just five swords, because there's not a lot about the warriors, and most people think about the samurai sword and all these things. But I wanted to show that the old swords are very different, and because they have writings that were buried with warriors, they are probably the best sort of artifact at these early times. And then from there, I follow chronologically, and so the early chapters are more about like courtiers and people writing about warriors. And it's not until I get in the 13th century where there's the creation of a new warrior government called the Kamakura Bakufu, or the Kamakura Shogunate. And at this time, these warriors start creating laws. And by the act of creating these laws and other precepts leads to this upswing in documents. The warriors are able to inherit property. And so you see that they start governing, they start managing lands. And because of that, you start seeing this real increase in documents. So if you look at the book, even though it covers from 471 to 1877, it really 13th, 14th century is where the documents get extremely rich, and we go on from there. And so the principle is, again, roughly chronological, but also I want to get sources that talk to each other. And I know often we do things where you have accounts that have differing perspectives, and I'll do that. But what I, one sort of really interesting subtext, I try to get different, totally different sources that will actually corroborate other sources. And so for example, I have one case where there's this one warrior who fought against the Mongols, and it's the Takizaki Suenag is his name, and he wrote these Mongol invasion scrolls. And he didn't have a good reason for getting rewards, but he went to Kamakura, and he was just so annoying that they gave him some lions and a horse and told him to go away. And then after that, I translate a law amendment which says no one can come to Kamakura and petition for rewards. And so, and that just shows that, you know, the difference of the specific versus how, you know, the law and how they dealt with this in general. Well, there's another case, some cases where there's assassination attempt of an emperor with one of these warriors that runs in, and he's in his armor. So the subtext of that one is I don't believe the ninja existed when they're actually fighting. And this is a perfect example because the assassin comes out in red armor, comes to the palace and say, hey, where's the emperor? And it's a very funny account. But then I show other documents that reveal the response to this. So I really... What I've tried to do in a lot of cases is show that a lot of these sources can be relied on, and they are reliable because you just see these other connections. And so that's what I want to show as well.
That is absolutely interesting. And when I was reading the book, one of the things that I enjoyed the most was the various genres of material. So we have letters, and you said we had the law verdicts. So what types or genres of materials have you selected in the book, and what was the criteria for selection?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I wanted to try to provide somewhat representative examples, but other things that are intrinsically interesting. And I would just pick based on the different times what would would cover that, you know. And so like one of my an earlier one, there's the famous Tale of Genji, which is supposedly an account of courtly love and all that. And I provide this one little known vignette where one person goes to the provinces and you have this warrior who's a terrible poet. And I think that shows, you know, how they try to respond to the court. But I just tried to give as many representative examples. And that's where, if you notice, the types of sources change over time, because at first the warriors are being talked about. And then starting after they make their laws, they do their court cases, you see they start producing documents. And then I'd say then you start getting more personal letters. And one of my favorite accounts is actually sort of this whole cache of letters that was discovered in a Buddhist statue by a warrior to his family. And then from there, they govern more. So you see the movement toward law codes. And interestingly enough, after 1600, they're at peace, so everyone starts writing autobiographies and just start talking about themselves. And so it's kind of they really do change over time, and what they talk about changes over time. So you could even see, like, when do they start talking about money, and you could see that that's a shift. And so I do think that's a sort of a help with the chronological perspective, but again, it was more interest than anything else, I would say. Depending on the time, actually different genres come to the fore. That's probably what I would say. And that accounts for most of the difference, really.
Fascinating. Now, in the beginning of our little chat, you mentioned that there are some existing understandings or conceptions of the warrior culture that might not be completely accurate. So, before we dive into the documents, are there any important concepts that you think the readers should know in terms of major historical concepts or, like you said, existing potential misunderstanding about the warrior age?
Well, I would say that that's a great question. There's a couple key points, I'd say. One is that people are fighting. But the idea of a warrior order, like the samurai order or something, that comes in late. That comes into being really in the 1590s, where you actually have a clearly distinct defined status. And if you look earlier, you see that there are hereditary specialists that are fighting, but a lot of other people like commoners and all that are also fighting as well. And I think that's sort of one key point, is that the, you know, even though it's called, you know, the samurai and the warrior culture of Japan, technically the samurai order really appears in 1590. It's abolished in the 1870s. So that's the latter half of the book, whereas the more general warrior culture is something we see that goes back to these early swords and all that. So that's probably the one misconception. And then the second one is just this idea that these people are loyal to a lord and they're willing to die for someone and do this. I mean, I think that's overdone. Like the feudalism trope where that they receive lands for their lord and because of that, then they fight to the end. In fact, that's really not the case. And so, you know, if you look at the book too, one of the richest sections is the events of the 14th century. And there's actually the collapse of this first warrior government. And I tried to provide all these different perspectives. And not only that, but the accounts, even from different perspectives, often are reinforcing that they will sort of prove the same points, just to reveal that what is motivating people isn't loyalty to any lord. It's either religious considerations, larger political things, or a sense that their lineage is destined to rule. But you don't have this larger solidarity to other warriors at all. I think it's much more specific than that. So those would be the two major points, I would say.
That's quite interesting. And actually, the when I first got into Japanese studies, I thought I was going to write my MA thesis on this text called Hagakure, which I think your book also covered a bit of. Hagakure, for our listeners who might not know, is a classical Bushido textbook. Well, it's called the Bushido textbook now because it was widely used during the Second World War as a sort of a propaganda education material. But this book that talks about how warriors, how samurai should behave, written in the early 18th century, the person who wrote this book had actually never fought in a war. So it almost read like this warrior who longed for something that he never had a chance to do, but he had all these rosy ideas of how a samurai should behave, which I think a lot of people don't get is that the warrior culture, like you said, in the 14th and 15th century versus ones from the 17th, 18th, and even the 19th centuries are very different. So I'm really glad.
I know, I tried to show that. And one thing is actually for that text, I really had fun. I mean, I picked the famous, like, The Way of the Warriors Found in Death, but I actually tried to do it because I actually feel that he's grappling with, to me, the older warriors had a lot more autonomy. And so his focus even on the importance of death and all this other stuff, it's a way of showing that you still have some autonomy in things. And so there's this one, I'll give you an off-color example where the last one I gave is where they said there's this one really powerful, you know, a spearman, and where he says, why don't you become my follower and I'll give you half my domain. And then the guy goes to a veranda and urinates off it and says, I couldn't do this. And I think that that's an interesting point because it shows this nostalgia is also for this autonomy of the past that you, and I think that's what the earlier warriors were. They weren't loyal to a lord. They were loyal to their holdings, their house, their family. And those rights that they had or something was a legacy of Kamakura and its laws. Because once these warriors got their own land rights, they would take the name of where they managed. And so that becomes so enshrined with their identity. And they would, if someone tried to take it away, they would fight over that. So that's a real difference than how they're later remembered. So I he is interesting. He is interesting. And I get he was a very frustrated man, I think, in many ways. So
yes, I totally agree. Now, when this warrior culture is presented on the Western screen or TV, so this interesting thing is a lot of the portrait of samurai war, the focus is given to the medieval period, so the 14th to 16th centuries. And your book, like you mentioned, begins with the 5th century, ends with the 19th century. So in ancient Japan, in the beginning, what were warriors like?
Well, that's, I mean, you did have conscription. So you had people in a village, like a few people to be selected, and they had to serve their whole life. And so there are actually some, they wrote some poems, there's some poignant things, but that early experience, it's much harder to get a sense of, but they would be more infantry, larger numbers, people conscripted and moved all over Japan. And I'd say it's a very different experience than how we imagine it. It's just, it's so much more remote. That's why I decided to sort of, you know, to more just sort of skip over that fairly quickly. One could do a volume about that a lot more, but it'd be mostly writing with other poems is how I would say it'd be the source. So that's what I would say, but it's harder to know. And even the earlier times, like I do show like how it's hard for people to estimate the size of armies. And I do provide how courtiers will portray the warriors in certain ways. But to get the warrior's own voice, as it were, it's really, it comes through the laws, through legal cases, and then ultimately through letters and these other things. So it's more like we can't know as much about their experiences until later. And that's where I think it gets richer in some ways. I can guess, but it's just a lot harder to know. And so that's why I really want to show that sort of, you know, what we can know and just focus more on that than what we can guess about.
I see. So from the existing materials, what aspects of samurai life, warrior life, I should say, can we at least speculate? How did they get selected? Like you said, how did they train? How did they live?
I would say that by the time, for most of the coverage of this book, conscription ends and it becomes hereditary. So it means that to be a warrior, actually you have to be able to skilled at archery, which requires practice from a very young age, and riding horses. And so what it means is that for most people, it's much more socially limited. But what I find interesting is there's a term called hyakusho, which means common, or means in modern Japanese means peasant. But in the letters I translate the 14th century, some of these people have horses too. So we know that in fact the number of people who could ride and have some proficiency was greater than we would imagine. I would say. But there is, but it's, and even though I say there's no warrior order, everyone is extremely status conscious because you have those that can lead others in battle. And it's basically based on who has a house. If you have your own house, you have your own property, and then you can lead followers and you have autonomy. If you don't have your own house, you have to serve someone else. You have to be with them. And in that sense, there's more of an obligation to be what I would call loyal. But those people don't write their own documents and don't do their own thing. So what's interesting is you have this sort of real gradation. As far as training, you can get some sense from maybe some chronicles and stuff, but they don't really talk about it. But other aspects of what they believe in and all that, that's where, like, later on when I provide some of their prayers and oaths, and that gives you, I think, a better sense of their sort of, you know, worldview in a lot of ways. But I think the laws are also very, I have a lot of law codes that come in, but I do think that the laws were very central to what they're doing. And if you read the laws carefully, you can get a lot of sense of actions that they did that the people in charge didn't like, you know what I mean? So I think there is a richness there. And like one of my favorite ones is like, you know, one of the tropes is Japan, as time passes, goes to a period of warring states and you have violence and all that. And I have sources that talk about the war and all that. But one of my favorite law codes, this is in the 15th century when it's supposedly in chaos. And one of the lords say, people keep coming into my garden and peeping into my mansion. Stop it. I'm tired of people just looking in my house. And it's like, well, that means there are no walls, no fortifications. It's a totally different world than we imagine. And I think that often these reconstructions of the past see it as more like, you know, big castles, and they miss a lot of the fact that it wasn't always fighting all the time. And I think the violence was much more constrained until the 16th century. So I would even argue that you know, even though you have civil wars for a long time, the number of fatalities are less, and sometimes you have like these major political disturbances at a time at peace, and you might have thousands of people purged, whereas in the Japanese wars, particularly the 14th century, you have casualties would be like 700 would be a major battle, you know, something like that.
Wow. Fascinating. And listening to you talk about these different materials, it sounds like the types of materials saw a transformation. We see more law codes. We see more just writings in general by samurai, by the warrior class. So as the court, the imperial court, rose to power and had a better system, sort of from the 11th and 12th centuries, how did the warrior culture transform? And I guess another question we should probably ask is, how come we are seeing more law codes written down around this time?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I would say that, so earlier, there's still the notion, you know, even after conscription ends, there's the notion that the warriors will serve the court, will serve courtiers. And so some of my earlier accounts, they talk about like there's a bad noble and he collects all these warriors and they throw rocks at the neighbor's house and all that. So these people would be incorporated into a court network. And also its court offices, court titles are very prestigious. And these people exercise authority as agents of the court. And so that's really what I'd say, that they're very much under the control of the imperial court in a lot of ways. And it doesn't really change until there's a war in 1221 when this new Kamakura regime fights the court. And the reason why they fight is that they had created a sort of an ad hoc, it's a title called Jito, which means like land steward, manager, whatever. And that was something that the principle was, if you received it, you could keep it and give it to whomever you wanted, including your wife, children, multiple children's, and it's a little apocryphal, but even like a dog. Okay. And so because of that, that was a limit on court power. So the emperors are still, you know, they don't like limits on their power. So you had a civil war in which the court was defeated. And the court was defeated, and I have a letter about this. It's interesting because it's more, if you think in terms of legitimation and everything else, of course the court's going to win, but Kamakura was just practicing, and they had experienced wars before, so they just moved so quickly that people couldn't really think. And they just showed up, and people joined their cause, and they defeated the court in a six-week war. And And then they banished some emperors, and then they decided they would regularize succession. So from that time on, they don't run the show. That's one misconception, that then it's the warrior rule. It's like, no, they have judicial and policing authority in sort of a limited way throughout Japan, but they also then start creating laws for these Jito. How can you maintain these rights? Who do you give them to? How do we deal with inheritance disputes? And that's where all this really sort of happens, I would say. So it's, and then those codes, which happen in 1232, it's a couple years after the war. It's like people are trying to figure out who gets my lands, and so that's why Kamakura regularizes it. And from there, those codes are kind of glorified. So I actually show in later centuries, even 3, 4 centuries later, how people plagiarize parts of the codes or they refer to them directly. It's kind of like, in the English legal tradition, the Magna Carta is a foundational document, and that's 1215, I believe. And here, these codes are 1232, and they're very comparable in a lot of ways. And I think that puts Japan on a very different trajectory. Lots of things change then. There's limits to court power. Buddhism changes because the court, all Buddhism isn't linked now to the court. And even names change. I don't talk about this in the book, but as I said, the warriors take their names from their lands. So you see this explosion in the number of surnames. That's why there's so many different surnames in Japan. It really comes back to that particular moment in time. And so that's why I talk about that, and that's why I think the trajectory is so different, that they go into governing and administering, and then we start seeing personal letters. I mean, I'm really happy about those letters of the 14th century because they show a different side of that. And we don't really see that kind of personal thing again until they start writing their autobiographies.
Now that you mentioned autobiographies, as we're moving to the 18th and 19th centuries, a lot of the texts you selected are from autobiographies. Whereas, the previous centuries we had more letters, poetry, government documents. So why is there such a change in the types of materials from 18th and 19th centuries, and why are these warriors writing autobiographies all of a sudden?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I have a, I mean, maybe they have more time on their hands. I mean, there are other documents. So they are administrating, but they're doing a lot, but that's so dry that I just decided that they're not fighting. So a lot of these documents have nothing to do with what we would think the warriors are doing. I did a couple. I mean, sometimes I think that why they write about this is they're very conscious of change. So, like this, the one of the accounts is the autobiography of Arai Hakusei, and he talks about his grandfather's father and himself. And it's so interesting just to see how they're dealing with, to me, the difference of when earlier warriors had their own lands and fought for them, and then later on they lost all their lands. And how they dealt with that, and actually had to serve a lord. So that's a wrenching thing. That's back to why the author of Hagakure was so upset about things, because it really, there's like, what is the rationale for their existence and so on. So I what I found interesting is that they're trying to justify their existence, but like the Arai account, two things that really shocked me. One is I have an episode where there's, I call it like a psycho samurai, where a guy got caught fishing, he gets upset, and he starts just going around killing people. And he'd leave his little calling card, and then he disappeared. And he disappeared for a number of years, and then they found him like 20 years later. And where he was hiding in his ancestral lands. So he had no connection, but he left there, and the people remembered these were our lords of many years ago, and so they protected him. So that shows you those older attitudes are still there. And then the other thing, actually, it surprised me. This is only when I was doing the index of the book, is that he talked about where his ancestors came from and how they moved around, and he mentioned where they originally were located, this province called Hitachi, and where I had those 14th century letters was also the same place. And actually, in those letters, the person who said to his wife, "If I die in battle," which he did, "rely on the Arai family to help you out." And I think it's the same family. So it's kind of like, these connections you can make, and it's a big country, but it's still a small world in some ways, and so you can find a lot of links. So I guess that's what I would see about those accounts. And some of the ones are also late in the Tokugawa period as well, because but they're writing about, again, the trauma that happens in the 1860s of the Civil War. Or there's another one that Luke Roberts translated about a warrior who was involved in the Korea campaigns and then lost a battle at Sekigahara. But I think they write about things when they have to deal with these wrenching transformations. I guess that's what I would sort of say, and trying to make sense of the world. And after they do, just go on and talk about other things.
That is absolutely fascinating. So my own studies about the 19th century, and even though I look into fiction, some of the writers turn out to be samurai, and it was really funny to see how in the beginning, how samurai wasn't supposed to be involved in vulgar literacy, such as popular fiction. But then towards the end, we're seeing people who are dipping their toes into writing popular fiction, even though they didn't quite sell. So
they're doing a lot. I mean, and the other thing I actually wanted to bring out, because often, like at the later times, people see it as being so different. So one of the last things I translated were these petitions that date from 1868, and that are almost the same format from the 14th century. So I also want to show that for all these wretched transformations, the literary and bureaucratic culture is actually incredibly durable. That, can you imagine, 1868, people are adopting the format of the 1360s, and they're doing the same thing, even though the warfare is completely different. So that was sort of another thing that I wanted to sort of include in there.
Indeed. Now, how does this book relate to your own research? Actually, I don't think we've really talked about this, but what does your research focus on, and how does this book, I guess, fit in your entire bigger picture?
Well, I've written a couple of monographs, and one of them is called State of War, the Violent Order of 14th Century Japan, where I look at the warfare of the 14th century as being transformative of political, intellectual, and all these other developments. And so a lot of those materials obviously made it into this work, you know, and some petitions. There was a chronicle called the Taiheiki, which had this sort of comical episode of people that were, you know, trying to besiege a castle. And that's something that I actually translated as a graduate student in like 1993. So miraculously, I was able to keep that file, that word file survived and made it into this book. So I'm happy about that. The other work I did is a study of the Mongol invasions called In Little Need of Divine Intervention. And so that's where I provide an account of this war named Takizaki Suenaga. And so he makes it. As some codes and as some of the records there, but then I add other things. And I also wanted to have kind of a link. There's an attempted invasion of Korea in the 13th century, and then I wanted to provide some sources about the 16th century invasion as well, just to kind of look at those connections. And the next point is, I actually, as I did my research, I wrote a book called Sovereign the Symbol, and in this one, I realized that the warriors weren't the ones who always wanted to fight. They were often in the peace faction after all, because they're dying and all that, like, we want to stop. But it was certain courtiers and monks, which for them, the political competition was a zero-sum game. And they are the ones that propelled these wars of the 14th century. And so also I put in then, there are some letters of monks, and I try to give a sense of, there's a monk named Kenshin who was like the most loyal advisor to the shogun in the 14th century. And one subtext of this work is the notion of loyalty and dying for a lord comes out of the monastic nobility. It doesn't come out of the warrior culture. And I actually show that because there's this one prayer where the monk, he was like, I know the general's sick, so let me die before he does. And that's in there. And then he does die. And then the general's like, wow, he preserved my life. And he starts copying these sutras and so on. So I wanted to reveal that aspect of things. And then finally, I've been looking at the Warring States period and these different lords like the Ōuchi. And so those laws made it in. So in some ways, it's kind of a culmination of all my monographs of what I've done. I make references to this, but it's also stuff I've done for classes and all that. So it's not just meant to be me sort of spinning off sources I've used, but it's like, as I've done my research, I wanted to provide the most unique and original and illuminating ones. And how many samurai source books have letters about monks fighting in battle for their gen? It's not what you expect, but I think that's an important side of things.
Yeah, it's just wonderful that you're able to make all the connection from all these years.
It's like I've been wanting to do this for a long time. And so I had stuff, but also I was lucky that during the COVID time, I mean, everything's locked down. And so I actually had some of these sources here, and there was a visiting scholar named Horikawa Yasufumi, and he, everything shut down for him, and here he was. And so we actually, hey, let's work on these law codes. Because the law codes are actually the most challenging thing to translate, I would say. The language is very laconic. It's very specialized. And I would say that probably one of the biggest scholarly contributions will be a lot of these law codes, just because they're so difficult. The Common Code of Law of 1232, this is the second translation that's ever happened. The first was in 1904. Oh gosh, I think it was 1904 or something like that. I could have had the year wrong, but it's again. I think it's a big contribution there.
Indeed, it is. Now, out of all these documents, these sources, we've covered some of them already. But do you have a favorite one?
That's really hard. I mean, so I'd say I've talked about the letters, probably of the Warriors family. That might be my favorite one. That's probably the one that I translated that's a favorite source would be that one. And since I've talked about, but I'd say for other works, things I've included, I'd say one of my favorite things is actually from my advisor at Stanford, Jeffrey Mass. He did a case study, and you have this law case. And what's really great too is you have a woman who is a warrior involved in guard duty, and you have this whole case about her land rights. So that I could include that in there, along with there's another warrior called Shigetoki who wrote these like precepts, and I'd say that they really come alive as well. So those are some of the ones I've included. Those are my favorite, but I'd say that for what I've translated, I really like the letters of this Yamanouchi Tsuneyuki because it just, they're very poignant. They're very sad in some ways because he's, you know, I mean, you really get a sense of this battle and he died and then they put the letters in a statue and it wasn't discovered till the 1990s. So I'd long wanted to reproduce those so that I can an article, but here I was able to basically put, I'd say about 80% of them in this book.
Nice. Now, my last question for you is a bit broad. So this book, as a source book, it will obviously be a great material for classrooms about Japan, Asia, and even world history. But in a broader sense, how do you think primary sources or historical documents like the ones included in this book could be used in the education of humanities and history?
That's a big question. So, I mean, one thing, this is maybe coming back to one thing that I think would be really helpful is what I would call like close textual comparison. Because if you want to just compare like the laws to the court cases or compare the laws over time, I mean, you could do a law class and use this as a book for that. But I also want to show like, you know, that I don't want people to just assume that a lot of this stuff is fictional or can't be relied upon. That's why it's, I think, a careful reading reveals like certain points. One account will talk about the general, you'll see it somewhere else, and they say the same thing. So I just think in terms of careful analysis and source criticism and then really pondering what one can know from these things and what one cannot know, it is a valuable thing. And so that was probably one of the key points of selection is that I wanted to get sources that speak to each other. I mean, there's like an account called The Clear Mirror, you know, and it's a courtier account. And, you know, I've talked about how I privilege like warrior accounts and their own voices, but this courtier account is actually stunningly accurate. And so the latter part of like the 1330s, I actually provide this account. And then if you read it carefully and read the sources I've done, you see letters, military documents, completely different prayers that actually back up this one account. And so I would that's why I'd say is like if people can kind of just use it, not even just to understand about Japan or the warriors, but about just thinking about what one can know and not know based on these sources, I think that would be helpful. And that's why I didn't want to do it like artificially, like one says something and the other says the opposite. And you say, oh, then the truth must be in the middle. I would actually be much more precise. Like some of these you just can't trust at all. And some of these you can really trust a great deal. And that's just based on a careful reading. That's what would be my hopeful goal. I also want to show Japan not being just so isolated. So that's where the Korea connection, I tried to bring that in as much as possible. But for the warrior documents, these cases are more limited.
That's wonderful. And if I can add a question to make this even broader, how do you see materials like this, materials about Japan, primary sources about Japan, could be utilized in classes or learning that's not primarily about Japan, but say world history in general?
Well, I think that's, I mean, I would say if you want to look at world history or something, I'm hoping that this is thematically broad enough that you could use this for a variety of different things. If you want to look at just military cultures, how our armies are organized, how do they estimate the size? I have a section on how people try to guess how large armies are. I could picture looking at Byzantine accounts and Mongol secret histories and Chinese dynastic histories and then looking at this. And so I'd hope that that would be something good for the comparative. If you wanted to do a law course, if you had look at the Magna Carta and its cases, and then you look at here we have the Japanese law codes and then their cases, and you could sort of, and then you could look at some, you know, Chinese codes, and you could look at other ones. So I'd say that would be another way that hopefully this could be used. I would hope that just people, even if they're not directly interested in the warrior culture, would look at this and learn something from it and make a variety of connections. And that's really my desire, is to, you know, what I've learned is this remarkable world is completely different from how I thought it to be when I was in junior high. To understand that, even if you don't know the language, and hopefully you could appreciate it and make your own connections and know it more, and also be skeptical of what's in the book too. That's fine too, you know.
That's truly wonderful. I really, really like this book, and I can't wait to use it in my own classroom and see how the students would like it.
No, thank you.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for this wonderful book.
Well, thank you very much, Inge. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you. Me too. And for our listeners who want a closer encounter with writings by Japan's samurai, make sure to check out this new book, Samurai and the Warrior Culture of Japan, from 471 to 1877, a source book by Dr. Thomas Collin. This is Jing Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.